The Tom Woods Show, episode 1838.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. We are in the middle of Scott Horton week, and today we're going to dial it up a bit because I'm going to bring up a complicated subject, and that is Syria, a subject I think we could all stand to know a little bit more about, and we know for a fact Scott knows everything there is to know, so we're going to take a little extra time in this episode. I'm just going to let Scott talk here. So Scott is just going to give us a big lesson on what the deal is in Syria, what the origin of the conflict is, and who the parties are, and all those sorts of things. We're going to review all that with Scott. You know, Scott, of course, is our great foreign policy expert, and he is the author, most recently, of Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, Scott. Now, to me, this is the heavy lifting episode. I mean, for you, I'm sure you could be doing 12 other things, but it seems to me it would be. The situation in Syria, in some ways, reminds me of the Balkans in the mid-1990s, in that I was in grad school at that point, and there was all this conflict going on in the Balkans, and I did not understand anything about it. And I thought, someday when I'm less busy, I'm going to go back and figure out what the hell was happening.
Right.
And so, you know,
I'm exactly the same way about that, by the way.
Okay, right. So about 10 years later, I did actually sit down and read about it. And I actually ended up writing a little bit about it in my 33 Questions book. But yeah, at the time, I thought, I don't even know where to begin. And I think, so the only parallel between the Balkans and Syria is simply that I think it just seems impossibly complicated to the average person. So I want a Syria for Dummies episode from you. I mean, treat us like we're seven, because really, kind of we are on this. Okay. First of all, what's interesting about it is that Assad, who's the dictator we're supposed to dislike, and they say he's a terrible, brutal dictator, you have quotations in your book that I had not been aware of. John Kerry saying, you know, I had a very fruitful meetings with Assad and talked about how we can strengthen the relationship. And of course, strengthen the relationship always means you do a bunch of things and we don't do anything. That is always what that means. And you say in the book that, okay, yeah, there were like six things he had to do and he did all six of them. And they freely acknowledged that he had done all six of them. So it is interesting how close the friendships can be. And then suddenly it just goes south. So what on earth happened?
By the way, I'm sorry, I have to mention real quick, because you mentioned your 33 Questions book. I was talking with Hunter Durensis last night, who's a great up-and-coming conservative slash libertarian writer.
Yeah.
And he told me a story of when he was 14 years old and accidentally picked up, I guess it was the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, but it was the Tom Woods book when he was 14 years old. And I think he said he was like a right-leaning hawk at the time. And then, blam, you just cured him of that.
Wow, that is so awesome to hear.
I just love that story because he just kind of came across it. And then now, you know, he's one of us for sure.
I'm trying to think. I think this is something like this happened years ago. Like somebody in his family contacted me and said, you know, this guy really likes you and his birthday's coming up. If you could wish him a happy birthday, it would mean everything. And I did it. And he just couldn't believe it. And I couldn't believe it either, that anyone would think that was such a big deal. But there are such people.
Yeah, no, that's great. And he's just great. He's going to be around for a long time, man. He's awesome. All right. So here, let me answer your thing here, man. And we talked about this before. People, you know, if you want to go back and listen to things I forget to say this time, they'll be in the earlier episodes too. But
and by the way, on my show notes pages, I always have links to every previous episode with a particular guest. So, for these Scott Horton episodes, that's a long list.
We debunked the weapons of mass destruction in depth there too, by the way, if people want to go back and check out that, because you brought up that point, but there are too many parts of Iraq to tell last episode.
Yeah, sure.
But okay, so basically, here's where we start. Iraq War II was a giant error in that, as I was explaining, they ended up fighting the whole war for the Shiite supermajority to take over the country. And they thought that, well, they'll need our money and guns more than they need their Iranian friends next door. But that was stupid and wrong. And so they kicked the Americans out. We don't need you anymore. Thanks for all the help. We won the war for the supermajority. And then they told us, now don't let the door hit you in the rear end on the way out, okay? Kind of a thing. And by the end of 05, beginning of 06 even, in the second Bush term, Zalmay Khalilzad and Elliot Abrams and some of these other neoconservatives finally got it through their head that we really screwed this up. And, you know, we'd been promised that it was going to work out this way and that way, but it didn't. And so now we've got to figure out how to make it up to the Saudi king and the rest of our, you know, Sunni Arab emirs and sultans and other, you know, El Presidentes and allies throughout the region, and the Israelis who helped lie us into that war because they thought it was going to be good for them, but it ended up empowering Iran terribly. I mean, by 1,000% or whatever, however you want to measure it, giving their best friends Baghdad. Not that they're total sock puppets or whatever, but they don't need to be, you know? So in the beginning of 06, they went to the Saudi king and said, we're really sorry. We're going to fix this for you. And they launched this project called the Redirection. And I've mentioned this on, I try to mention this on every interview I ever do, pretty much. Everybody needs to read this. Stop and spend your lunch break reading the Redirection by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine from, I'm almost certain, it's March 2007. And what it says in there in the most blatant language is, we really screwed up by giving Baghdad to Tehran. And so now we're going to fix that by backing Al-Qaeda terrorists all over the region in an attempt to roll back Shiite power and influence. The King of Jordan, on the occasion of the invasion of Iraq, coined the new term, the Shiite Crescent, right? This is the Iranian axis of evil. It's Iran, or I should say Tehran, now Baghdad, and then also Damascus, Syria, and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. So as I was explaining on two episodes ago about why they lied us into war, the neocons thought that if we invaded Iraq, that somehow that would break this chain of Iranian Shiite power through Syria and Hezbollah. Now, all we did was add another massive state to the Iranian side of the ledger. Oh, man. So they decided to start backing Al-Qaeda terrorists, Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, different Muslim Brotherhood groups, which, by the way, it was Liz Cheney at the State Department at this time was the one who started bankrolling the Muslim Brotherhood groups in Syria. And then they started backing a really dangerous group of bin Ladenites called Jandala in Iran. And this is not all in the Redirection, but it's a series. There's Preparing the Battlefield, the Redirection, and the Coming Wars. Almost certain all of them are 2007 by Seymour Hersh, and they have different levels of detail about this. But the main one is the Redirection. And they started backing these terrorist groups. The Saudis don't really have an army, you know, but they wanted to try to roll back Shiite power. But then the Arab Spring breaks out in 2011. And there's essentially a popular revolution breaks out in Tunisia and is successful. And the American-backed sock puppet dictator has to flee with a plane full of stolen gold for Riyadh, right? Well, in Egypt and all over the rest of the Middle East, people went, wow, you can do that? And I know that there are some conspiracy theories that say all this was a color-coded revolution type thing planned by the Americans in the first place. I don't think so. I think they backed a lot of these groups in Egypt, and then the whole thing got completely out of control. Once Tunisia happened, they took the reins of their own revolution. And it was every political faction in Egypt, you know, came together to support this thing. And they overthrew in an almost entirely bloodless, you know, end of the Soviet Union style revolution, a peaceful revolution. They overthrew the 30-year American back dictator Mubarak, and a Muslim Brotherhood guy won, and Americans overthrew him. Anyway, point being that once this Arab Spring broke out, there were protests in Libya and Syria, as well as Saudi and Yemen and Bahrain and everywhere. So America and Saudi teamed up. Here's what we're going to do. Wherever the Arab Spring threatens Saudi power, like in Bahrain, we're going to crush them. But wherever the Arab Spring can be used to expand Saudi power or even just get revenge against an old enemy, then we're going to go ahead and do that. And so that was when they targeted Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. He wasn't a Shiite or part of that axis at all, but they hated him. They had bad blood going back with him for a long time because he always made fun of them for wearing dresses like women and kowtowing to the Americans and all this kind of stuff. So they hated his guts and wanted him dead. And so they essentially hijacked the Arab Spring in Libya, and then skipping on, they did the same thing in Syria, where again, Assad, who is an Alawite, which is sort of a break off of the Shiites, I think it kind of precedes Shiite Islam, but then sort of merged with it way back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Anyway, they're very closely aligned with the Shiite Arabs, the Alawites are, and he had an alliance with Iran. Now, as you said, he also got along with the Americans. He doesn't have a religious like devotion to the Ayatollah or anything like that. This is all politics. And he was definitely not a sock puppet dictator like Hosni Mubarak, who would just, you know, follow whatever orders he was given or anything like that. but he was trying to get along with the Americans, and he was cooperative in the war on terror, including torturing people for Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, including an innocent Canadian that they tortured within an inch of his life. Mistaken identity. You know how the Republicans are. And now he was accused of helping funnel fighters, Sunni jihadist fighters, into Iraq during Iraq War II. Now, I think there's probably some truth to that, although mostly he just didn't have control over the situation. But the degree to which he was being cooperative in letting them go there is probably because Richard Pearl and all of his friends had announced that Syria, you're next. And he had a real reason to help keep America bogged down in Iraq and not able to move on to him. So it was self-fulfilling kind of a prophecy with picking a fight with him there. But anyway, by the time of the John Kerry quotes that you're talking about in the Obama years, Iraq War II is over. And Kerry is saying that, no, look, they're being very cooperative, and especially on border security and keeping jihadists from continuing to go into Iraq to cause trouble and this kind of a deal. So, and if people aren't familiar, you know, go look at him in your Google images. The guy wears a three-piece suit and he shaves his chin every morning. Now, that doesn't mean that America should back him. Backing a bunch of, you know, tyrants over there is what got us attacked in the first place. But for God's sake, we shouldn't be backing a bunch of bin Ladenite terrorists to try to overthrow him. You know, let the people of Syria figure this out on their own. And instead, what happened was the foreign powers led by the United States and Saudi Arabia, and then very quickly following Turkey, Qatar, and Israel, essentially hijacked the Syrian Arab Spring protest movement within a couple of months. They started funneling Saudi jihadist terrorist fighters, the same guys who we called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the enemy, during Iraq War II, the worst part of the Sunni insurgency. They started sending all those guys on to Syria to fight. And for people like me and our friends at antiwar.com who are keeping track of this all through the year 2011, not looking at hindsight, but looking at it all the way through, we had all of these evidences. You know, from John Hanna and Alistair Crook and Eric Margolis. And John Hanna was one of Cheney's guys, bad guy writing in foreign policy. Alistair Crook, a great guy. Eric Margolis, an American hero up for all time. And leaks from Stratfor by Jeremy Hammond, the leaker, not Jeremy R. Hammond, the pro-Palestinian guy, but Jeremy Hammond, the hacker guy who leaked the Stratfor emails. And a couple of other evidences all were coming out through 2011 that the CIA, working with our NATO partners and working with our Gulf state partners, are now on the ground in Turkey, backing and training and financing and arming the jihadist, you know, uprising, essentially the bin Ladenite led uprising against Assad. Now, at the same time this is happening, I should rewind a second to Iraq War II. In Iraq War II, when America fought for the Shiites in the east of the country, and to put them in power in Baghdad, they pushed the Sunnis into a very radical insurgency. And it's, you know, 4,000 out of the 4,500 Americans who died in Iraq War II, you know, died fighting the Sunni-based insurgency, the worst, most radical part of which was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had never existed before the war. And in fact, was a fake excuse for the war when Colin Powell lied and pretended that Zarqawi was tied to bin Laden and Saddam when he was tied to neither. But anyway, in October 04, a year and a half into the war, he finally declared his loyalty to bin Laden. And, you know, his group ended up becoming very prominent, especially in the propaganda, but also in real life, in terms of the damage that they did there. But then in 2006, the local Iraqi Sunni tribal leaders turned on these guys. They're mostly a bunch of, yes, Syrians and Egyptians and Saudis. And, you know, yeah, we're all brothers under Islam, sure, but we don't like a bunch of Egyptians coming to our town and telling us what to do, you know? And so, no. And they started marginalizing them and betraying them. In fact, they turned over Zarqawi to the Americans. And the Americans killed him in a drone strike, or I guess it was an airplane airstrike. And so it wasn't David Petraeus and the Surge, the Awakening Movement and all that. That began a year later. It was the local Iraqi Sunni tribes who turned on their most vicious allies and got rid of them for us and all of humanity. And George Bush turned all of Western Iraq into jihadi university, created thousands and thousands and thousands of these guys, just like it was Afghanistan in the 80s all over again. And then the local Iraqis murdered them all for us. Oh, phew. what a relief, man. Like, you know, I'm not for violence or whatever, but, you know, things could have been a lot worse than that. The local Iraqis killed them. Sick of them. Now, that was 06, 07. Now, what does Barack Obama do in 2011? He just comes with the defibrillator paddles and brings them right back to life again. Resuscitates them right back to life again. Hey, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who every Iraqi hates, even your former allies, we got a battlefield for you next door in Syria. Want to fight? And there they go. You know, whatever was left of them, dozens, high dozens, scores, low hundreds, went and immediately crossed the border into Syria and started hijacking the revolution for their own purposes. But like I say, that was absolutely in line with what the Saudis were already doing. So the way to understand the Syrian war from 2011 on is, sorry about the peaceful protesters who want democracy. Sorry about the leftists who want to form a labor union. Sorry about, you know, whoever it was that was just sick and tired of the Assad family and wanted to hold regular elections and have some accountability instead of living in a dictatorship. The reality is that their points are all moot the moment that foreign powers invade the country. You know, say we're all overthrowing Biden. It's a giant protest movement. We pass a new constitutional amendment. We can recall him. We hate him so much. And see, I got off on a tangent about how much I hate Biden. And I forgot what I was going to say, Tom.
that happens to us all, Scott.
Yeah. And then a foreign power was intervening, right? A foreign power came and said, yeah, no, this is our movement. The Russians, the Chinese, or the Mexicans, or something. They come and say, yeah, we want rid of Biden. The major European powers are trying to overthrow him. Well, you know what? That makes you and me their tools now. Sorry, because you know what? Our power doesn't compare to the power of Great Britain. And if Great Britain's in the middle of a plot to overthrow our president, the same one we hate, I mean, you can think, imagine if that was the case, we would all rally around Biden because independence comes first. Simple as that, you know? Just like in Venezuela, they prefer the commies to the guys with the lick of market sense because the guys with a lick of market sense are sock puppets of the CIA and they know it. And so they prefer socialism and starvation and independence. And so that's the situation here is that, yes, there were peaceful protesters. Yes, there were moderate rebels, even fighters who, if they had their way, they would have tried to create some sort of democracy. But just the point is, they were all rendered almost completely irrelevant and moot from the very beginning because it was Al-Qaeda and it was these foreign powers who were essentially just invading the country. Then they spent 5 years pretending that, no, we're just helping moderate democratic rebels fighting for freedom. And in fact, even worse, Tom, they just turned the whole thing into, you know, they never had to explain it all the way because it wouldn't make any sense. But the way that they talked about it, they always implied that the reason there's a war here is because Assad decided one day to murder every last man, woman, and child in his country. And ever since then, America and our super friends have been trying to save the civilian population of Syria by arming them to resist his aggression. And that's essentially all you need to know. And if it wasn't that he just woke up one morning in a bad mood, oh, okay, it was his overreaction to them holding a couple of peaceful protests. What a fascist that he would commit a genocide just because a couple of people showed up at a protest. But see, that's just a lie. It's just not true. And these guys were terrorists. We knew from the very beginning, from 2011 and 12, they're committing atrocities. This is Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria, you know, doing suicide bombings of elementary schools, murdering Druze for refusing to convert, shooting a kid. There was a kid with a vegetable stand or something. And a guy said, hey, can I get a discount on this orange? Can you give it to me for half price or something like that? And he said, buddy, I wouldn't sell you that orange for half price, even if Mohammed came back. And an Al-Qaeda guy went, what did you say? Bam, and shot him in the face, a 14-year-old boy, and killed him. And these were the American moderate liberal heroes that we're arming. From the very beginning, we knew they were monsters. These guys are Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's all they are. And then the CIA coordinated the whole thing. The Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, of course, played a major role. Also the Jordanians and the Israelis, just funneling in billions of dollars and weapons.
Hey, folks, I'd like to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. You know, I say on the Tom Woods Show that the show improves your life. Well, I'm not kidding about that. Blinkist is an amazing app that makes it possible for you to learn an enormous amount in a short amount of time. It takes thousands of nonfiction bestsellers and condenses them down into their core ideas in the form of 15-minute text and audio explainers. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories, including self-improvement, personal growth, management, leadership, and mindfulness and happiness, but also history, economics, and other topics. I like Blinkist because when I'm driving around, a half-hour commute means I've consumed the equivalent of two books. I recommend an interesting book I just read through Blinkist, Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, but they also have some libertarian classics as well, like Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman and For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. You can also use Blinkist's shortcasts to quickly catch up on podcast episodes you've missed. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Here's the thing I fundamentally don't get about this.
Okay.
In some cases, when the U.S. intervenes, they have in mind, standing in the wings, some person or group that will replace the people they don't like. So in Iraq, you had Chalabi giving advice as to what the U.S. should do. What did the U.S., what was it foreseeing? What was its preferred Syria? What would it look like? How would it be governed? How stable would it be? Who would be in charge? Had they thought this through?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Exactly right, Tom. You know, and I had said on my show, I remember talking about this with Eric Margolies and then back when I first started learning about David Wormser and Richard Perle and the Clean Break Plan. After we do Iraq, we want to go to Syria next and whatever. And I bet you could find this in the archives from 04 of me asking Eric Margolies. With the little I know about Syria, I know about the giant Hama massacre of 1984, where Bashar al-Assad's father killed like 20,000 people in order to suppress a violent Muslim Brotherhood uprising. And then it's a dictatorship where all political competition is outlawed. So then I says to Margolies, well, look, if they get rid of Assad, then who's left, right? I mean, it seems like the obvious answer is the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's if you're lucky. It could be a lot worse than that. But the Muslim Brotherhood would be the only organized force in the country prepared to inherit the power. Guess what? Liz Cheney thought so too, just like in Egypt. Liz Cheney at the State Department in the Bush years began this project to finance the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, because who else do we have? And I should say, by the way, my understanding is, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood are mostly a bunch of rich old men, you know, the conservative religious right, as opposed to the radical religious right. And in Syria, they are much more analogous to just bin Ladenite murderers, you know, radical revolutionaries and extremely dangerous war criminal ones. And so if you go and look at the famous, should be famous, Hillary Clinton interview from February 27th, 2012 on CBS News. And this is the famous clip. It used to be in the intro to my show where she says, well, Al-Qaeda has endorsed the revolution in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? And the rest of the quote, she talks about, you know, oh, and this is, I realized this when I was researching the book. This statement she's giving is 3 days after the big Friends of Syria meeting. And I forgot if it was in Doha, in Qatar, or in Tunisia. They held a couple different ones, or it might've been in Turkey. But anyway, they just held a giant Friends of Syria meeting to figure out who they could prop up as the new, you know, government in exile. And then here she is 3 days later. And she says, and by the way, I should clarify, Hillary was the worst person in the entire Obama government on this, at least while she was there. She left at the beginning of 2013, but she was on his case all through 2011 and 2012 to make things worse and worse and worse. And she attacked him for not making it worse once she was out. Okay. But in this interview, she's being put in the position of being forced to defend her president's policy. She's just the Secretary of State. He's the president. And his policy is, hey, I'm a little hesitant to do this. Maybe we'll arm them a little, but I don't think we're going to carpet bomb Damascus and really see a regime change. I don't know, you know. So she's in the position of defending his policy. But I think she's being completely honest about this. And anybody watch her in this video, you'll see. She's totally right. She goes, look, Wyatt, who is the CBS reporter, You know, when we go to try to find out who are a group of responsible, moderate people that we could see that we could, you know, build a new government out of, we don't see that. We can't find the right people to put in there. And this is after they've been working on it for a long time. CIA and state and NED and whatever have been working on this for years, going back into the Bush years. And then they take, you know, their pets and they go, these guys are completely incompetent. This is never going to work. And that was at the beginning of 2012. It was Hillary Clinton herself saying, Tom, we don't have anyone to replace the Assad government with. And yes, if he's gone, the Baathist government falls, the whole government is dissolved. And we have to replace it with something else, something we don't have, something that we can't even imagine how we're going to get from here to there. And then anyway, she spent the rest of the year pushing for it anyway. And I will say, I've got to be fair to the devil here, man, if I'm going to get this right for people, that she argued, and I think she probably believed, that look, man, we got to really arm the moderates and train the moderates and work with the moderates and build them up as fast as we can so that we can overthrow Assad and that we can marginalize the more jihadist terrorists. It's not like she's just sitting there cackling going, ha, 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 I'm friends with Al-Qaeda now or something like that. Her idea was, if we really arm the non-Al-Qaeda guys, that'll marginalize the Al-Qaeda guys. But that was just crazy and stupid and wrong, and it always was, and she should have known better. And in even the New York Times, by October of 2012, maybe even before that, but certainly by October of 2012, David Sanger said in the New York front page of the New York Times, all the money and guns we're sending into Syria, they're all going to the jihadists. These guys are leading. They are the revolution here. Everybody else works for them. And the CIA is coordinating all these different countries and all this different aid. But there is no real vetting going on. And it's the guys who don't mind dying who are getting all the guns and doing all the fighting and leading the fight. And it just stayed like this for years. They kept pouring in and they were training guys down in Jordan and in Egypt. They're coordinating them as a joint room. They called it command room in Jordan and in Turkey. Where did I say Egypt just now? That was a slip. In Jordan and in Turkey, they're running these rooms where they control these terrorists or try to and organize all the funding of them and everything. And, you know, 500,000 people died in this absolute catastrophe of a war. And then I got to talk about ISIS real quick, but I'm not going to break off into Iraq War III. And we'll probably do a separate section on that in a minute, or, you know, tomorrow or whatever. But the Islamic State of Iraq, ISIS, that is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They started calling themselves the Islamic State of Iraq back in 06 after Zarqawi was killed. And it was a joke then. It's like, you guys don't even control a single city block somewhere. Now you're the Islamic State of Iraq, you know? But it sure showed what their idea was and what they had in mind. So al-Nusra is essentially Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria. And then what happened was in 2013, it's a little complicated with the names, but they just rebranded Al-Qaeda and started calling it al-Nusra, which is like Jabhat al-Nusra, like the Association of Helpers or something like that. But then in 2013, there was a split between the Iraqi-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria and the Syrian-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria. And it was a fight over oil and also over, you know, power and control. So Baghdadi was the boss of the Iraqi faction and Jolani, the head of the Syrian faction. And they split. And Zawahiri sent the leader of Ahrar al-Sham, which was another just alias essentially for Al-Qaeda there, and one that you can read in Foreign Affairs, why we ought to be backing them. An Al-Qaeda-linked group worth defending, they called it in Foreign Affairs. And they sent the leader of Ahrar al-Sham, Zawahiri did, the leader of Al-Qaeda, to broker an agreement. And the leader of ISIS murdered him and said essentially to Zawahiri, you know, screw you. You can make the law, but you can't enforce it, you know. And we don't want to wait. We want our caliphate now. And so where the Al-Qaeda strategy was just keep fighting until the Americans are finally exhausted and go home, and then we can try our revolutions, which they never had any ability to do before we turned the whole region upside down for them anyway. But Baghdadi said, no, I want my caliphate now. And he carved out essentially the eastern half of Syria and made it a sovereign Islamist terrorist state, south of Kurdistan anyway. I don't mean to include Kurdistan there. And then 1 year later, they rolled right into Western Iraq and created the caliphate. And then after that, we launched Iraq War III to then destroy the caliphate. But just to show that that's where it came from. It was Barack Obama and his government in alliance with all of our regional allies and our European allies too. The French have a major interest in Syria, for example, played a major role in all of this. They did this. When Donald Trump said that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are the founders of ISIS, that was not hyperbole. That is a fact. It's just science. It's the history of the world. That's what happened. And in fact, you know, at that time, Trump was palling around with Mike Flynn, who had been the head of the DIA. In fact, you can read, there's a Seymour Hersh article called Military to Military. And it's about how Flynn was insubordinate. Flynn is a very bad person, by the way, and crazy and horrible on Iran and dangerous and whatever. But he's not a pro-Russian traitor, and he's not a pro-Al-Qaeda traitor either. And when he was the head of the DIA, he was absolutely insubordinate to Obama and was passing intelligence to the Germans to give to Assad to use to kill the CIA's terrorists on the ground. And he got fired for that. That's why Barack Obama fired Flynn, because Flynn was helping the Germans help Assad kill Al-Qaeda, who were working for the American CIA. So this was the guy who was palling around with Trump. So when Trump was running, in fact, the very best take on this is the speech he gave. He's like reading the speech. It was written this way. It wasn't just off the cuff. It's the speech he gave at the National Interest Foundation, the one where he was introduced by Zalmay Khalilzad. And he gets up there and he says, Obama created ISIS. And I'll tell you how he did it. First, he backed the jihadists in Libya. Then he backed the jihadists in Syria. And then he pulled all the troops out of Iraq. And so there was nobody there to keep ISIS from rolling in and taking over the western half of the country. Now, I got to admit, on just a scientific, factual basis, that's true, right? If the Americans had still been in Iraq, they would have presumably been able to carpet bomb the ISIS convoy rolling into Mosul and on down to Tikrit and Samarra and Fallujah and the rest, but they weren't there. But the real point is step one and step two. Obama and his government were guilty of the highest treason you could possibly imagine in Libya and in Syria for years. And then they didn't have troops in Iraq to keep the bad guys that they had suckered out. And that was what happened. And Trump got that right the first few times. But then without Mike Flynn, he wasn't able to say that anymore. And it had real consequences, because then the lesson became, forget step one and step two. How did Obama create ISIS? He pulled the troops out of Iraq. That's all you need to know. And what's the lesson there? You can never pull troops out of anywhere ever, because what about ISIS? Because what if there's a terrorist that you leave behind somewhere? And since it comes to people like, you know, me and other foreign policy critics, you know, real hard cases about it, you know, the Hortons and McAdamses of the world to focus on this, ever since Donald Trump dropped the first two parts of that argument, they've been missing from the discussion all along. And so the consensus is you can never pull troops out anywhere. And even Trump, they got rid of Flynn and they got rid of Bannon. And then it was in August of 2017, Trump said, we're escalating in Afghanistan because we learned the lesson of Iraq. You can never pull troops out of anywhere or else ISIS might take over. And that's it. The safe haven myth has been given this giant brand new lease on life when it was really Obama's treason in Syria, much more than his withdrawal from Iraq, that caused the crisis there. But they can never admit that. They would rather kind of consign that criticism to the realm of conspiracy theory or something like that. But that's the history of how it happened. And then, by the way, I want to mention a couple more things here, Tom, which is that John McCain famously went and met with a bunch of Syrian fighters in 2012, in May of 2012. And Rand Paul famously falsely accused him of meeting with the leaders of ISIS. And that was some Alex Jones crap that was going around the internet that was just wrong, where they identified the men standing next to him with the wrong names. Oh, look, there's Baghdadi. But that's not Baghdadi. It's somebody else. I forget all their names now, but they're individual human men with names and they're identified and they're not the leaders of ISIS. Who they were the leaders of the Northern Storm Brigade. Well, it's the same difference. Guess what? A month before McCain went over there to meet with them, they did an interview with Time Magazine where the guy says, yeah, when the war broke out, I went over to Iraq to fight the Americans. He is essentially admitting that he was what the Americans at that time would have called a foreign fighter, Al-Qaeda in Iraq terrorist. And they, yeah, we proudly went and fought the Americans in Iraq War II. We're all veterans of that. And then a month after that was when McCain went and met with them. And then it turned out that this was the same group that had kidnapped a group of Lebanese Shiite pilgrims and murdered them all. And then it turned out, Tom, and I know I've heard you talk about this on the show before, this was the same group that kidnapped Stephen Sotloff, the American / Israeli journalist, and or I don't know if he was intelligence officer or what, but at least he's known as a journalist. They captured him and they sold him to ISIS for $20,000. And then ISIS cut his head off. So Rand Paul was one inch out over his skis there. And if he just toned it down one notch and said, John McCain's friends there are essentially indistinguishable from their allies in ISIS, that was correct. And then the rest of the moderate groups all turned out to be murderers too. The Al-Farouk Brigade, oh, they want to hold elections and have a democracy. But here's their commander on film eating a dead soldier's heart. And, oh, here's Nur al-Zinki. The CIA gave them TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles, and probably, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for years. Here they are cutting a kid's head off. And, you know, he looks 12 or 13 in the footage, but it turns out the guy was 19 and looked young for his age. But he's a Palestinian refugee. What's he even doing there? Some Israeli is living in his grandma's house, is why he even lives in Syria in the first place. And the Israelis insist that we fight this war to weaken Assad is another whole part of the reason this poor kid was even there. And you know what? Cutting the head off a 19-year-old ain't much better than cutting the head off of a 12-year-old anyway. I mean, they're just monsters. They're monsters, and they were the whole time. It was led by the worst people the whole time. The peaceful protesters, they went home a long time ago. And then, by the way, Tom, see, here's the other thing, man. After the creation of the Islamic State in June of 2014, and Baghdadi declares his new name as the Caliph Ibrahim, leader of the caliphate, from the balcony of the Grand Mosque in Mosul, and all of this. That was in early summer 2014. Obama and his government continued to back not directly ISIS, but every other terrorist group in Syria for years after that, through the rest of his presidency. Donald Trump didn't call it off until the summer. It was, I forget if it was June or July. I think it was July of 2017. And so even though we're massively bombing Fallujah, Ramadi, Tikrit, Mosul in order to destroy the Islamic State in Western Iraq, they're still aiding and abetting them in Syria, at least de facto. In the spring of 2015, when ISIS rolled into Palmyra, the Americans, they could have bombed the convoy. No problem. They had forces. They were already fighting ISIS in Eastern Syria as well. They could have sent in a couple of B-1 bombers to take out the entire convoy. Instead, they let them sack this city where they tortured and murdered the head of antiquities there. This was a, you know, ancient Roman ruins and all of this stuff. I mean, it's crazy. The memes that go around, it seems like this has got to be not true, right? But it's real. There's a meme, I've seen it before, where it's a bunch of ISIS guys. Oh, it's a bunch of ISIS kids. And they have Syrian soldiers on their knees. And these kids, you know, like young teenagers, 13, 14-year-old boys, are being made to cut their heads off. And it says, American democracy. And then the bottom picture is a bunch of ballerinas dancing at a, you know, society opera thing. And this is under the fascist dictatorship tyranny of Bashar al-Assad. And they said at the time, they admitted at the time, well, geez, if we bombed them in Palmyra, then that would have taken the pressure off of Assad, who was under assault by CIA-backed so-called rebels, al-Qaeda, and mostly al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, the worst of them, other than ISIS, in the Idlib province up in the northwest. And so the assault on Palmyra by ISIS in the south was helping to weaken him and keep his forces divided. Why would we intervene even against ISIS if it in any way would help Bashar al-Assad? And then a year later, when Assad's forces with Russian help liberated Palmyra, Mark Toner, the American State Department spokesman, and you can find this on YouTube. I mean, it's unbelievable. He sat there and hemmed and hawed and stuttered and I don't know, until finally the Associated Press reporter, Matt Lee, virtually, you know, puts his arm, you know, twists his arm behind his back and says, damn it, Toner, admit that it's better that Assad rules Palmyra than ISIS. Admit it. And he, okay, fine. Fine, I'll concede if you absolutely put a gun to my head that I guess we prefer Assad controls Palmyra to ISIS controlling Palmyra. And these guys make Benedict Arnold look like a hero, Tom. They make me look like I'm crazy just for telling the truth about them and the depths of the treason that they committed. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Scott, before we wrap up, I want to see if you can give us a brief word on where exactly, as of this moment, especially with a new president, things stand. What does Biden have, do you think, have any policy in mind for Syria? I mean, where do things stand right now?
Well, I mean, I can sum up Biden for you real quick here, man. He is ending the Yemen war, which is the most important thing. Well, the second most important thing in the world. And that is huge. And I talked about that, as you mentioned, I talk about that at length with Thad Russell and some others. So we won't delve too far into that. But he's not really ending the war. He's switching sides in the war back to the war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is still a tremendous improvement over the current war for them, which is just madness and genocide and treason. So that is good. And he re-signed the New START treaty with Russia. And that is the single most important thing facing all of humanity. That's the last treaty that limits the number of, you know, reserve and deployed thermonuclear weapons and strategic long-range missiles and all the rest of it. All the other treaties are expired on the long-range H-bombs, Tom. It was the last one. Trump let it expire. Biden came in and saved it. And thank God Putin said, hey, let's extend this thing. And Biden, and for all of his horrible anti-Russia hawkishness, isn't crazy, you know, on that. So those two things are huge. And then I got nothing but bad news. Oh, no, one more thing. I think, you know, they're talking a lot of smack now, but I think it's almost certain that they will get back in the JCPOA, not because the Iranians are going to bend to their new demands, but because the Iranians are going to continue to build up their civilian nuclear program in a way where it becomes pretty much, you know, more in the term latent threat, it'd be more threat and less latent, you know, in a way to really force them to the table, which is exactly what happened in the Obama years back in 2015 anyway. And I think that, I mean, he'd be crazy. I can't imagine. Obviously, the Israelis are going to be a pain in the butt about it and everything. But if they let the JCPOA, the Iran deal, just die and they don't save it after the aberration Donald Trump came and ruined it, I mean, that would just be an absolute disgrace. Okay. But I think that I just kind of can't imagine that. So I think that they will save the Iran deal. But then I got nothing else but bad news for you because, well, forget Russia stuff for the time being. But in the Middle East, they're going to keep the war on terrorism going forever. So in other words, I don't expect any more regime changes. I don't expect any more. Man, if they go back to trying to back Al-Qaeda in Syria, because they're not all the way dead, the Turks are protecting them in the Idlib province right now. It's within the realm of possibility that they could go back to Obama's policy there. But when the war is over, that ship has sailed. I don't, if they try to restart Syria like that, I'm going to go completely mad. I just can't imagine that they would do it. It's just too late. And there's nobody else that they can attack who can't fight back. And so what's left is angry Sunnis with rifles. And that means anywhere from Nigeria to the Philippines, we can send special operations forces to fight against Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or against Al-Shabaab or against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. As I said, half of the Yemen war is going to continue. And that includes any kind of mythical or legendary Arab friends of the Taliban in Afghanistan, if anybody can find one, and this kind of thing. And he's going to break the deal that Donald Trump signed with the Taliban. It's already, they haven't officially announced it, but they've leaked it 10 times. That they're going to break the withdrawal deal with the Taliban and stay in Afghanistan, which is going to be a nightmare because the Taliban are going to go back to war. What are you going to do then? Now you only got 2,500 guys in the country. We just went a year without losing any American soldiers in the Afghan war. And then they're going to break that. Instead of pulling out the last of them, they're going to get them back into a fight. And it's going to be terrible. And the way, I'm just making this up, Tom, but I must be right because it's what I would do if I was a horrible, evil Democrat in this situation. Is they're going to leave him in. They got to drag him just over the 2-year line so that then Kamala Harris can do 10 years. She'll be able to, under the 22nd Amendment, she'll be able to run twice more, even if she inherits just under 2 years, just under half a term from Biden. And so under that scenario, you're looking at status quo, more or less what they consider low-level conflict against associated forces of Al-Qaeda, broadly defined. And, you know, on the big projects, I mean, most likely we won't have a major war because the big project is building up for the Cold War against Russia and China. And then we all just have to hope that everybody knows that they're just kidding and they're just using, you know, these countries as an excuse to rob us blind and that they don't really mean to fight Russia or China under any circumstances, right? But then that means, you know, somebody's got to keep SOCOM busy, you know, everybody. And that's the whole thing about these wars too. Back to the self-licking ice cream cone. It just so happens, Tom, the Navy is really interested in what to do about China. And the Army is really interested in what to do about Russia. And the Special Operations Forces are really interested about what we're going to do about jihadists in Africa and the Middle East. And it's not just a matter of where they're being deployed. It's a matter of their own selfish interest of what can we do to not have to get real jobs. And there's a great quote in the book about the Africa stuff, a couple of great quotes, where they just say essentially outright in the most cynic's libertarian language that, well, you know, after the drawdowns in Iraq and Afghanistan, we're looking for other things to do. We're trying to find ways to stay globally engaged. And so we're going to Africa. We got a government program and we need a reason for it. So we're looking around. And that's how it goes. And I see no indication that he's going to pull us out of Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan or Somalia or anywhere in North or West Africa in 4 years. If he does all 4 years, I don't think it's going to end any of those wars. And if he does, it's going to be because the American people made him, not because that was what the Democrats had in mind at all. What they have in mind is CIA drone wars and special operations wars against bin Ladenites, broadly defined, wherever they can find them from now on.
Well, Scott, obviously one thing that would make people think a little bit more about these issues. I mean, right now we've been distracted by everything that's been done to us domestically, but of course would be the widespread distribution of your painstakingly written and extremely convincing book. So I want to urge people, don't just listen to these episodes this week. That's great. That's a good start. But go out and get Scott's book, for heaven's sake. You can find it linked on the show notes page. I'm also going to put on the show notes page the articles, the Seymour Hersh articles that you mentioned. I'll link to them. I found all three of them, so I'll put them all there at tomwoods.com/1838. So the book is Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism by our guest Scott Horton. Scott, we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks, remember the purpose of this week is not only to give you an opportunity to hear from Scott, but really to promote his book to you. He's one of the hardest working people in our whole movement. He has an enormous amount of knowledge, and he has put pen to paper so that you can hold in your hand a chunk of Scott's knowledge, let's say, okay? Because a lot of times he talks and we think, how could we ever master all this? But if you have it on the paper, you can just look at it as many times as you need to. And he's very punchy and engaging, as you might imagine. So check it out. I've linked to it on all the show notes pages for this week. So the book is Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. tomwoods.com/1838, once again, is the show notes page. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.